This is John McGuire, and you are listening to Pentimental on SyncBook Radio. Today, on episode number 14, we have joining us for a one-on-one conversation, podcaster, blogger, and host of The Bridge with Kira, Kira Young, as well as a trialogue with podcaster, author, and host of C-Realm Podcast, KMO. Rejoining me this week is my usual co-host and brother, Tom McGuire. On this episode, we delve into questions of social ecology and existentialism in the Western industrialized world. Having experienced themselves firsthand the trappings and hard diminishing returns of misleading mainstream narratives, they each seek to educate others about potential reality tunnels that operate outside the dominant mythologies of our day. While on one hand, they manage to keep their feet firmly tethered to the physical dimension, they also acknowledge the value and utility of higher aspirations of the mind. Thanks again to my guests this week, and thank you for listening. Joining us today on Pentimental is KMO. He's a longtime host of the C-Realm podcast, which focuses primarily on issues such as peak oil, sustainability, as well as a topic near and dear to our hearts, consciousness. He's also authored the book Conversations on Collapse. So, KMO, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And making his glorious return as co-host this episode is my brother Tom. So, welcome back, Tom.
Of course.
So, KMO, can you just give us a bit more detailed introduction to maybe who you are, where you come from, and what the C-Realm podcast is.
The question of what the C-Realm podcast is a funny one, because you'd think I would be the expert on what it's about, but I'm not so much. I had the C-Realm domain from, I think, 1995, and I was using it primarily as a vehicle for publishing my comics. And then the comics went by the wayside in the early 21st century. They petered out somewhere in 2001, 2002. And the website was just kind of sitting there. And then along comes podcasting. And I realized I had been preparing to do podcasts for my whole life, really. And I was doing a podcast within a month or so of learning of the existence of podcasts. And my early podcasting brothers in arms were the Dope Fiend of the Dope Cast and Lorenzo Haggerty of the Psychedelic Salon. A little later on, Doug Lane of Diet Soap, he joined that crew. And yeah, that's, if you listen to the C-Realm podcast with an ear to early episodes of the Dope Cast and Psychedelic Salon, you can hear certain things that I picked up from Lorenzo and the Dope Fiend, which stuck. And the Dope Fiend doesn't do his show anymore. And I don't know if Lorenzo has stuck to the exact same format, but I used the Creative Commons license because Lorenzo didn't think a lot about it other than that. I learned of bumpers. You know, the Dope Fiend show was really well produced. And so I started it's not a habit exactly. It's a practice. The various podcasters who are aware of the shows that I've mentioned, they contact a woman in Australia who goes by the handle Black Beauty to do their bumpers. And I was the first one to ask her to do that. So I was kind of the genesis of that meme, which I don't know how many shows she's done bumpers for now. Quite a few. About consciousness. When I was in grad school in the early 90s, I was taking a course in Hegel, which is not my thing at all. So I don't really care to talk about Hegel, but I had to write the word consciousness in my notes so many times I just came to abbreviate it as the letter C. And then I thought, oh, you know, that'd be a good name for a comic strip. So there was an opening in the university newspaper comic strip page, and I applied and got on, and the name of my strip was C, just the letter C. And I was a graduate student at the time, and I was teaching undergraduates logic and ethics and things like that. And I wanted to keep the personality of the graduate instructor separate from the personality of the cartoonist, because the comic strip featured a lot of nudity and was intentionally provocative, and I just wanted to keep those two personas separate. So Kevin was the teacher and KMO was the cartoonist. And then when I left grad school, I moved to Seattle. I got on very early on with Amazon.com, and everybody at Amazon got called by their login. And I was there early enough that my login could have just been Kevin at Amazon.com, but I said, oh no, make it KMO. And thereafter, every day for 2 years intensively, because, you know, it was an early startup and people worked long hours and whatnot, I got called KMO. And so that's when it really cemented. That was 96 to 98. And then in the, 2005, 2006 range, about the time I was starting the CROM podcast, I got into basically a lot of debt, credit card debt. You know, the money from Amazon had run out and I was trying to make a living and not doing very well and, you know, having to charge things to the credit cards. And then credit card people would call me and other people would call me trying to collect on debts. And if they called and they asked for Kevin, my heart just went cold. And I knew that this person was, they didn't know me. They were just reading my name off a screen. It got to the point where I stopped answering my phone. And I don't carry a smartphone these days. I do have a regular cell phone that I use when traveling. But for the most part, I'm just not a phone person. And a lot of it stems from that period. And these days, if somebody calls me Kevin, and for some reason, some people are uncomfortable with KMO, I don't think it's a particularly difficult thing to say, but there are a few people I know here in New York who insist on calling me Kevin, and every time they do, they're just affirming the fact that they don't get it, that I have asked to be called a certain thing, and if you insist on calling me something else, then you are insisting on taking a sort of adversarial relationship to me, which is entirely your choice, but I'm offering every opportunity to step back into the, you know, the friendly camp. And some people say it sounds like a rap name. I don't know what to say about that.
Well, can you let us know? So you started off a bit with questions of consciousness with your comic strip, but how then did you start to transition into stuff like peak oil, sustainability, cultural decline, these sorts of questions?
Yeah, when I started the CROM podcast, I was a singularitarian, a extreme techno-optimist. I thought that the robots and artificial intelligence and nanotechnology and genetic engineering were all going to swirl together in this big cauldron of plenty, which would just spill out over us anytime now. And I then discovered, I think Dmitry Orlov was the first person I talked to about peak oil. He had a PowerPoint presentation online. It was called Closing the Collapse Gap. And he was talking about the Soviet Union and the sequence of events that not only led up to their collapse, but put them in a pretty good position to weather it compared to the United States. You know, for example, there wasn't private housing. Nobody in the Soviet Union had a mortgage that they were trying to pay and they could lose their house if they couldn't pay it. You know, everybody just lived in their state-appointed apartments. And while it was overcrowded, they were in no danger of being thrown out. Nobody had cars. You know, they had mass transit, which even in times of currency crisis, the subway token still worked. You could still get on the subway. You could still take a bus. Because the Soviet system was never very efficient at providing for people's needs, people had to provide for their own needs. So lots of people had these garden plots, which were not anywhere close to their house. They were out in the country. So maybe they'd send one family member out into the country to tend the dacha. And basically everything that made the Soviet Union sort of dysfunctional was an advantage after it collapsed. When I had him on the show, that attracted other people who were interested in the same thing. And one thing led to another. And I kind of went down a rabbit hole for a few years, got very collapse oriented. I've since come out of that.
Dmitry Orlov was interesting to me for various reasons, but the main point he made that stuck with me was there was a tighter knit sense of community in the Soviet Union, and they still had all these issues. And like you said, they still had all these quote unquote safety nets, so to speak, but they still had a really hard time. And now here in America, we're playing with all this funny money and collapse is inevitable. And then the question is, what's it going to look like here when our kinship networks are weak, to state the obvious, and everything's connected through cars and sprawl? So how are people going to get what they need, how they need it, and how are they going to convince people to do anything for them if they can't pay them? Because our kinship ties don't exist anymore. Community doesn't exist anymore. And so that premise too is even scarier, because our system is so much like the communist system, only without, again, those safety nets like you just mentioned.
Oh, he's a very interesting guy. Yeah. I know him personally. You know, I've been to his boat. I've seen him in many places. You know, we end up at the same places like the ASPO conference or this gathering in the woods that used to be held every year in Pennsylvania. The organizer will kill me if he ever hears this, because I can't remember the name of it. It was basically the last sort of collapse-oriented gathering, and it's not meeting this year either. So that whole community is sort of disintegrating. Dmitry Orlov doesn't talk about collapse anymore. He's on to other topics. So it's kind of gone by the wayside.
So how have you transitioned out of that modality? Because it seems like collapse is something we'll have to deal with someday. But are you more interested in focus on solutions or some other tangential subject matters? Or how do you see that?
Well, I defer very much to John Michael Greer's position on this. Talk of solutions is sort of nonsensical. What we're facing is not a problem. Problems have solutions. What we're facing is a dilemma. And dilemmas, you have choices that you can make, some of which lead to better outcomes than others, but there is no solution. The collapse, I think, is ongoing, and civilizations collapse at a speed where if a civilization is in freefall collapse, an individual human being can live their whole life and just think everything is normal. So I think that's where we are. Over the course of my life, I have seen the transition from a time when a single wage earner in an unskilled job could support a family, buy a house, send kids to college, to now the assumption is there will be two wage earners and they are struggling. You know, they're struggling just to stay ahead of their debts. And that is collapse in slow motion. It's taken decades for that transition to really get rolling. And now it seems to be complete, but everybody has thought that everything was normal every step along the way. And I think that will continue. I heard a story yesterday about how people basically do internet in Cuba, and somebody with a decent connection downloads a bunch of stuff and they put it on a thumb drive, and then they just go to door to door and they say, hey, I've got the new Game of Thrones. I've got the new Orange is the New Black. What do you want? And people, you know, that serves them. I think that the internet we have now is really extravagant, you know, with all the full motion video and loads of ads and, you know, all these sort of Frankenstein advertising blogs and all this content that is generated algorithmically. If all of that was just stripped away and it was just people writing text to other people and maybe uploading photographs, we could do with a lot less of the infrastructure that we have now. It could run on a lot less energy. And I think that we can fall a long way from our current position and still enjoy a pretty decent quality of life. And I don't think that anybody on this call is going to live to see, you know, the Mad Max future. It's a fantasy. It's a lovely fantasy. And it's one I've enjoyed delving into my whole life. But I do think that is a fantasy.
It's funny you bring up John Michael Greer because I'm reading his book. It's called Blood of the Earth. And he focuses on this question that we have this kind of false dichotomy going on in politics where you have the far right and the far left, and all of them are missing the point on key issues, and no one is willing to walk the middle ground or to pick and choose bits and pieces from each to merge a more constructive philosophy. And also he makes the good point that even when people know these things or know the issues, changing behavior is a whole other question, because things are hardwired into our monkey brains and our survival mechanisms are always sort of overshadowing the rest of our hierarchy of needs and pushing and pulling us in these self-destructive directions. And I have to say personally that I've moved away from the premise that, yeah, there's going to be a mass movement to save us. I'm forgetting the exact philosophical position. It might be called ameliorism or something. It's this concept that pockets are the most likely thing to survive and the fate of the world is, we're not necessarily moving towards total destruction. We're not necessarily moving towards total salvation. There's always something else that's going to materialize that we don't expect. And the question is, well, how do we approach that in our individual lives, day to day, and maybe for those in our communities and those close to us? But I guess, like, how are you choosing to move into the future if we can't convince everyone to get on board, so to speak?
Basically, just staying busy, really. You know, I do two podcasts a week. I try to do a comic strip every week. It takes a lot of my time. And yeah, I don't worry about the state of the world. You know, I think obviously destruction could be a physical state, but I don't think salvation is a physical state. I don't think it's really dependent upon our material circumstances. My personal material circumstances are much deteriorated from a couple decades ago, but I'm enjoying life more now than I did then.
Yeah, I feel like all in a lot of ways, we're kind of resigned to just observing and reporting and either attracting like-minded people or repelling people that are turned off by the concept of, I guess, having to envision a future that's much, much different than the one today. But that's interesting that, again, you've been doing the podcast for a while now, and obviously your opinions have changed over the course of that. And did you come in with sort of a fixed set of beliefs and really that changed heavily over the course of doing the podcast?
I was a pretty doctrinaire libertarian when I started the podcast. And I've not only drifted away from libertarianism, but American libertarianism has changed considerably over the past decade. And a lot of the things that drew me to it are de-emphasized now. And the things that I sort of held my nose and put up with are center stage. My personal views, my reality tunnel, you might say, if you're into Robert Anton Wilson or BS, has definitely changed. And now I'm actually seeking out Marxists and talking to Marxists and you know, getting a Marxist perspective on how things have gone. But I think also just the general observable change. My libertarianism went hand in glove with being at the center of the dot-com boom, you know, in Seattle in the mid to late 90s. And then, you know, I lost a house to foreclosure in 2008. So my personal fortunes have really buoyed, they've gone up and down with the general state of the U.S. economy. And, you know, being hounded by debt collectors and really scrambling to try to make some money and not making as much as I need to support the lifestyle that I thought was mandatory, it's just not consistent with a libertarian perspective, you know, not as it's articulated in the early 21st century in the United States. You know, that word libertarianism means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So it's not just the podcast and the constant talking to people, you know, in depth about particular ideas, but just my changing life circumstances and the changing socioeconomic circumstances that everybody I know is undergoing, which has led to a change in beliefs.
You also, at certain times, the topic of psychedelics comes up, because I think maybe earlier in your journey, you did some ayahuasca ceremonies and that informed some of your perspectives. And I guess, is that still a focus for you? Is that still part of, if there's no collective solution and there's just sort of the individual solution and making sure you sort of acclimate yourself to a different way of living and seeing yourself and viewing the world? How do you view psychedelics now as you've gone on this journey?
The day after a powerful psychedelic experience, I think, oh, this is important. There's got to be some way I can articulate this and present it to other people and have it be useful. And when I haven't had a powerful psychedelic experience in quite a while, and I look at people who, you know, I won't mention any names, but there are certain sort of cult figures in the psychedelic underground, particularly here in New York, that I don't see them as being particularly enlightened in their own behavior. Mm-hmm. And I don't see that they're bringing a lot back from the psychedelic experience to offer. You know, what they have to say, which is of value, is stuff they read in books from other people. So when I'm not just off a powerful psychedelic experience, I think it's largely irrelevant. Well, not irrelevant. I won't say irrelevant. I mean, obviously the psychedelic experience was foundational to, you know, the early pioneers in computer graphics. Forget who it was, but you know, Ralph Abraham did an interview, I think, with GQ or Men's Journal or some sort of mainstream magazine like that. And he mentioned that he thought at least half of the early pioneers of computer graphics were influenced by psychedelics. And the interviewer was skeptical. And so the interviewer went to the SIGGRAPH conference the next year. That's the special interest group in graphics. It's a big computer graphics conference that takes place every year. And talked to as many of the early pioneers as he could find. And he said, no, it's not half the early pioneers. It's all of the early pioneers who were really influenced by psychedelics. And, you know, obviously psychedelics have thoroughly integrated themselves into the mainstream corporate aesthetic that you see on TV or on, you know, Netflix or Amazon or however you get your audiovisual entertainment. It's all very psychedelic, but I don't think it has led to any sort of deepening of the culture. I think the culture is as superficial now as it was in the 80s or in the 50s or, you know, pick your archetypal self-centered, self-satisfied decade. We've got a lot of psychedelic experience informing our aesthetics now, but I don't see that it's really made people particularly wise.
Have you seen any applications of it that you would consider to be valuable?
Oh, certainly. People with PTSD getting relief with MDMA, people with terminal diagnoses who are taking mushrooms or other psychedelics in order to come to terms with their impending demise. I think that's all really valuable. And I'm glad to see organizations like MAPS and the various John Hopkins studies. I'm glad to see that the sort of lockdown on psychedelic research, which, you know, was most of my adult life, is being released. It's being loosened up. I think that's great.
Now, I guess going hand in hand with that, you brought up the psychedelic connection with computers and whatnot. And one of my favorite guys to read is Jaron Lanier, who is considered one of the fathers of virtual reality. And he's this very bohemian, interesting fellow who's always stressing that consciousness is not something that can be captured by a computer. This obsession with the singularity and this obsession with artificial intelligence is sort of a bottomless pit and a waste of time and so on and so forth. And it's interesting because he never talks about psychedelics, but it's clear to me that that's influenced his work too, because much of his work now focuses on virtual reality experiences where kids or whoever is a learning tool to experience what is it like to be a lobster, what is it like to be a molecule. And often you hear that from people coming back from psychedelic experiences. They say, I was this animal or I was this element or something to that effect. And it's funny that he's trying to use the technological fix to give people that same experience, I suppose. And so obviously, like, certain people in that world see it as valuable, but they never bring it up explicitly. But anyone that's has any familiarity with the experience can see exactly what they're doing. And so I see it's just like another example of this technological fix fetish. And I don't know what you, if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, I read Who Owns the Future by Jaron Lanier, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. I thought his analysis of what's wrong and what's gone wrong with the, not the industrial revolution, but the information revolution, the dawn of the information age, how it's really gone off the rails was great. His solutions, you know, my eyes glazed over, but I really enjoyed the first part of the book. I've talked to a lot of people about things other than psychedelics on the See Rome podcast, people who have absolutely nothing to say on the topic in public. And then when the interview is over and we're just chatting, time and again, they tell me how valuable psychedelics have been to them personally. And so I think it's really difficult to see where the beneficial effects do show up because people are not willing to talk about the origins of some of their passions. This is a bit of a segue, but I think you'll see the relevance. There's a person I've had on my show repeatedly. His name is Larry Lowe, and he describes himself, or used to, as a rational UFO researcher. And his familiarity with that community makes it important to him to put that rational in there, because it doesn't seem that most UFO researchers are particularly rigorous in their research.
Mm-hmm.
And Larry has come to the conclusion, and I can't really claim to be able to articulate his vision, but as I understand it, the shamanic experience, certain varieties of the psychedelic experience are very closely related to what he calls the phenomenon, or encounters with whatever it is that sometimes take the form of observations of flying objects. And his opinion, and I think he's right, is that it's really sort of foolish to try to grapple with that on a very literal level and make just point blank factual statements about, you know, nuts and bolts events. And he also told me a few years ago that he thought that people who had been participants in the phenomenon either got sidetracked really trying to come up with a literalist interpretation of what they had experienced, or they get past it and they focus a lot of the time on the health of the biosphere, the health of the planet, which I think is great. So, you know, maybe UFO encounters might have something in common with psychedelics in that once people get past the stage of, you know, trying to work it out in a certain sort of linear, rigorous way, and they just integrate the experience into their personality, then they reorient their values in a very helpful way. So maybe that's the antidote to my earlier sort of pessimistic statement about the value of psychedelics.
Yeah, no, that's a premise I've definitely come across before. I think I was first introduced to the intersection between shamanism and the ET and psychedelic experience with Graham Hancock's Supernatural, which is a pretty good book. And yeah, the line, where do we divide external nuts and bolts UFO phenomenon from just these sort of internal projections that are part of our collective unconscious, even though in so many ways our unconscious and subconscious is just a Freudian biographical swamp. At the same time, there is some sort of Jungian aspect to it, which is collective and not necessarily personal. And it's just odd that it's there to begin with. And aliens or ET or fairies or all these things that take people away and have these strange rituals with them, engage with them, is very psychedelic. It's very shamanic, and it's also very ET-like. And so I know I've done a show on that concept and explored it with a author, Mike Cleland. I don't know if you know him, and another woman, Mary Rodwell. And so they both explore that in depth. And, you know, it's nothing I fixate too much on because there's so many other things to go to go off on and to explore. But as a dynamic of consciousness and on that personal level, is if you manage not to drown in the confusion of it all, I think it can be interesting, productive, and help you take, yeah, a more nonlinear or just a different perspective on life, because I think so much of our stress and our negative perceptions of things is built into our programming. And I think whatever shakes up programming, not anything, but these sort of like spiritual technologies or whatever you want to call them, I think are useful. I think Derek Jensen called them spiritual technologies. I like that term.
We mentioned John Michael Greer earlier. He wrote a book about the UFO experience. I think it's just called The UFO Experience. And it's a good read. I recommend it. It certainly seems like it would match your interests. So definitely read it. But for people who are not going to read it, I did interview him about it. And that is in Sea Realm Podcast episode number 262. The title is Assume the Can is Open.
And what was his basic premise again, or his thesis?
Well, it's one that is really unpopular among UFO true believers and skeptics alike. Early on in the book, he takes us through a little tour of the UFO skeptics approach and how just absurd it really is. I mean, they will grasp at the most unlikely of explanations and say, okay, that's it.
Yeah.
You know, for example, an airline pilot, I think over Florida, had seen some persistent lights, and the UFO researcher who looked into it said, oh, it was fireflies trapped between the panes of glass in the airplane cockpit. Yeah.
Yeah.
How they got there, where they went, I don't know. I mean, that's an absurd explanation. He gives the example of Jimmy Carter had apparently seen a UFO with other witnesses. And the UFO researchers who looked into it said, you know, the skeptical one said, oh, they saw the planet Venus. And John Michael Greer said something to the effect of, suppose five people were in the parking lot of a bar and an 18-wheeler rolls by at 60 miles an hour. And, you know, that's an unusual occurrence, they reported. And somebody who is skeptical goes and investigates the scene, and they notice that across the street there's a tricycle. And they say, oh, those guys must have seen the tricycle and mistaken it for, you know, a big 18-wheeler. So that's early in the book. I think he probably gets a lot of people who are dedicated to the UFO topic to be on his side with that sort of rough treatment of the skeptics. But then he turns the tables, and he describes a tactic that the U.S. used before the Normandy invasion in World War II, where they set up these fake army bases in Britain, complete with inflatable tanks. They're just dummy tanks, but they were meant to fool the Germans into the exact location where the inevitable invasion would take place. And he uses that as a sort of model for examining his notion of the Air Force and various intelligence services and different people intentionally creating these fake UFO sightings, like towing big inflatable black triangular balloons across the night sky with an ultralight. And the point is that UFOs, they tend to take on the general shapes and characteristics of whatever cutting edge experimental aircraft are being tested at Groom Lake and Area 51 and, you know, places like that. And so he's not saying that's the entire phenomenon, but he's saying that's a big piece of it. Deliberate disinformation meant to conceal U.S. and in some cases Soviet advanced aircraft development. And then he says, you know, another part of it is a shamanic experience. People have this experience. They've been having it forever. I'm not going to explain what it is in this book, but, you know, there is definite crossover there with alien encounters and the UFO experience.
Yeah. And that's like in measuring all these sort of strange phenomenon, I think you always have to approach it from so many angles and measure them all and give them all their due and at least put a percentage on all of them as best as you can, because it's usually everything at once. And most people are function in a binary thinking sort of way. So it's hard for them to juggle different points of views, like the Robert Anton Wilson reality tunnel approach, which is maybe logic, which is, hey, all these belief systems are bullshit. Don't take that for granted. Acknowledge that. It doesn't mean you can't believe things necessarily, but the moment you start hardening to dogma, especially over these sorts of experiences that are so blurry between objective and subjective, that to take a hardline perspective on any of them seems awfully, awfully silly. So I appreciate when people like Greer come into the picture, and it might not be popular, but again, observe and report. How can you observe and report in the most honest way? And I appreciate that sort of approach to these kind of topics. And I think that's also what you do on Sea Realm too. And that's like why I've listened to you for a long time and really like the work you do. It's you come at these things from a lot of different angles. You're willing to walk that middle path, and that's the gray area. It's not easy to tread because it actually requires a bit more attention and a bit more effort, I would say.
I sometimes try to help people reframe their hatred of the right wing, particularly of controversial figures like, say, Rick Santorum. And I say, you know, look, Rick Santorum is powerless. He has no ability whatsoever to adjust the narrative that he has branded. He has people who give him large sums of money and respect and credibility to take a certain line. And it doesn't matter what he thinks about it. He's not free to change it. If he does change his line, if he does take a different perspective, then he's out. You know, the money that was going to him is going to go to somebody who is willing to present the narrative as it needs to be presented. And so what's he going to do in that circumstance? Is he going to do a lot of meditation, a lot of introspection, or is he just going to say what he knows is going to bring in the money and the support and just keep doing that? Now, with the C-Realm Vault podcast, which is the second weekly show that I do, which is for paid subscribers, now some people are paying me to say the things that I say. But for the first 8 years of the podcast, 7 years of the podcast, you know, the donations I was getting were minimal. I was not in the Rick Santorum position. You know, I was not in the Barack Obama position. I was not paid to take a particular point of view. And so I was free to change my mind as I needed to. And it's a great freedom to have. And it's one that people who seem powerful don't have.
And that brings up an interesting question about how much power the individual actors in our system have. And that's always, I think, the point of contention between the conspiracy people and the other people that are saying, well, no, it's the system we put into place. It's the machine that's running us. It's not so much the cogs in it. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. So I guess, how have you found an equilibrium between those positions of the individual actor having any power? Do they have any power? I mean, I agree with you. It doesn't seem like they have much. And really, our institution seems to be running us more than we seem to be running our institutions.
I think wealthy individuals, particularly people who are in a privileged position, they get to either create money out of nothing, or they get to borrow at 0% and lend out at 9%, which is basically a license to print money. They certainly have a lot of options that I don't have. And you mentioned ayahuasca a few minutes ago, and I have been to South America 4 times to participate in ayahuasca ceremonies. And when I'm there in the jungle, I meet people from all walks of life. I meet movie stars, really wealthy people, and I meet people who work for the government and don't want to give me their last name or don't want to say exactly what government agency they work for. I know that there are a lot of DEA and CIA people based in Iquitos, Peru, which is sort of the gateway to the Amazon and a hotspot of ayahuasca tourism. And there are people in positions of authority, power, privilege, and a lot of people under them who have had this powerful experience and this powerful connection to the natural world and to the more than human world, and you might say the supernatural world and the Graham Hancock sense. And so there is a lot of, I think, inner conflict and turmoil taking place around the levers of power. It seems that conflict is least pronounced is in Silicon Valley, where the ideology of, you know, Ayn Rand has given way to the ideology of Ray Kurzweil, but still hyper-capitalist. And they seem to be convinced that every disruption to the economy, no matter how many classes of employment it destroys or how it seems to concentrate wealth among the people, you know, as Jerome Lanier says, who have the biggest computers and can aggregate the most data, no narrative of how that might be harmful will be tolerated for a second. They are saving the world with, you know, every mouse click. They're saving the world. And the fact that they're getting rich in the process is just indicative of the fact that in our capitalist meritocracy, they are extremely meritorious. And so that's the place where I don't see a lot of critical self-examination or weighing of narratives or really clear thinking going on, which is ironic because, you know, it's centered in San Francisco, which is the birthplace of the hippie movement and, you know, the psychedelic experience in the U.S. on a mass scale. It's strange how the sort of dynamic center shifts around and doesn't necessarily follow the centers of financial success or political power or things of that nature.
What do you think is still the allure or the main allure of the singularity as someone that was into it for quite some time, or maybe not, I don't know how long, but what do you see as the main attractor there for people?
I'm certainly not original in saying this, but it allows people who are materialist atheists, often very antagonistic to organized religion, to get some of the benefits of organized religion, you know, to have this apotheosis, this rapture in the near future. And people who are singularitarians object to this, and I will acknowledge their objection. They say that, you know, if evangelical Christian thinks that the end is nigh. The evangelical Christian thinks that they personally will be saved, but most everybody else will be damned. And the singularitarians say, no, when, you know, the AI opens up the nanotechnological cauldron of plenty and pours the blessings over us, everybody will be uplifted. Which, you know, if you look at their, I just have to ask, okay, when is this shift from individual acquisition to collective benefit going to take place? Because the people who are most firmly wrapped in this narrative are driving as hard as they can in the opposite direction. It's not a blessing for everybody. It is definitely a blessing for the few, to the point where people who used to be doing okay, the American middle class, are not doing nearly as okay as they once were, you know, in terms of money and material wealth. Anyway, I try to represent both sides in these answers, but you can see which side I'm on.
Well, I think it's interesting how you have an understanding of so many different positions. And like you said, you were a libertarian until you realized that in your new current state, whatever that was at the time, was libertarianism wasn't working for you. And, you know, some people will claim that they are one thing and just stick with it forever, whether it fits who they are at the time or not, just kind of in a madness-oriented kind of way. So it almost feels like having all these different types of viewpoints out there is necessary, and that not one could fit what everyone needs or wants or is looking for.
Yeah, people, they invest themselves in an identity based on something they once professed to believe. And if that identity is, say, I'm conservative, I'm right, a Republican, even when the Republican narrative has clearly shifted and is no longer, it still flatters the waning middle class, but it's definitely in the service of somebody else. The fact that they've invested their identity in it makes it very hard to pry apart the association between this label and themselves. And yet, yes, it's a difficult thing to escape.
And so if that question of identity is so hard to escape, what do you think allows some of us to extricate ourselves from certain identities? I mean, is it just totally serendipitous that some of us opened our eyes to this, that some of us are able to transcend programming? Not completely, obviously. We're not better than anybody, but we seem to see things that others don't, or accept things that others don't. And I guess just, what's your view on that? Is there a type of physical nervous system brain change that has to happen? What does that represent to you, if that makes sense?
Well, I'm not qualified to comment on neurology. I think of it mostly as luck, but, you know, you are doing a show for a network called SyncBook, so obviously you can look at it from a point of view of synchronicity, or maybe having been led, or having been caught up in some sort of attractor. But I just think of it as luck. I happen to have the DNA that I do, mostly Irish, so I can talk and drink. And I have had certain experiences, psychedelic experiences at a young age. I happened upon certain books at the right time. And, you know, if I hadn't, would I be the person I am? Probably not. Would I be one of the people that I talk about as charitably as possible, as living unreflective lives and accepting absurd pronouncements without question? I kind of doubt that I'd be that person either. But, I can't really rerun my life and look at how things would be different. I'm on this single track. I can't pull back and look at, you know, a multiverse of different potential paths for myself. So I'm no expert, but I tend to think of it as luck and maybe some sort of extra help that I've received. And I can't really say what the nature of that help would be.
So in investigating all these cultural crises over the years, there's so many myths we live by, but what do you think is the biggest one that dominates our culture and is the one most standing in the way of people, quote unquote, waking up, if you want to use that term?
I think there are two that are probably tied, the myth of progress and the myth of separation or of separate individual selves. I posted something that was mildly critical of Elon Musk to the Friends of the CROM group on Facebook, and a lot of people really idolize him and think that he is bringing humanity to space, basically. And the whole notion that an individual human being is not an integral component of the biosphere of this planet and dependent upon being embedded in that biosphere for continued existence, the notion that humans can just jump on spaceships and go everywhere in the universe and be fine, I think is ridiculous. I've been watching Star Trek Enterprise on Netflix recently for the second time. You know, I saw it originally when it was aired several years ago, and now I'm watching it again. And certain aspects of it are just absolutely absurd. You know, everywhere you go, there are creatures that are shaped basically like humans, you know, roughly 2 meters tall, head with two eyes and a nose and mouth, two arms, two legs. And if they encounter something other than that, it's really remarkable and surprising. And, you know, they have this very convenient gravity plating, which frees you of the need of very expensive weightless effects. And everything can go down. Life support is down. Main power is down. Propulsion's down. But the gravity plating is solid. Everybody can still stand and walk around.
Yeah.
And the universe is not so friendly to our biology. The thing that I was telling people in this long-running thread on the Friends of the Sea Realm, and this is not my original idea by any stretch. I'm mostly paraphrasing Charles Stross, that the idea that you were going to send human agency out into the solar system in the form of canned apes, which is to say these metal containers with a chunk of Earth's atmosphere and a lot of water and food and, you know, waste disposal, just to sustain this biological entity, when you can send a robot out, which can exist in a hard vacuum, which can take the radiation, which doesn't need distraction. It doesn't have to poop. You know, it doesn't go crazy. If you do a rational cost-benefit analysis, sending canned apes never wins. It's this romantic notion that humans are not totally embedded in the matrix of life on this planet, which makes us think that we can go elsewhere and leave this planet behind. And I just don't see it happening, which is not a popular view among people who, for reasons that I can really sympathize with, get very nostalgic about space exploration.
Yeah, and that's something I love Robert Anton Wilson, but that's something I could never jive with him on, was this idea that, yes, space travel is the answer, that the only issue is that we're running out of territory, and that's why we're fighting each other. And I'm always like, no, we're fighting each other because we have these ridiculous systems that don't stratify resources properly and stereotype people and class people into caste systems. Who's mediating the space travel? It's not this libertarian, everyone has their own spaceship in their garage kind of shit. It's going to be run through giant monolithic corporations, and they'll pick and choose who goes and how it goes and the agenda that gets set. And I think that whole notion, right, it's like, okay, even if we get to space, what's it being mediated through? And then to your questions too, it's like you pile that all up and it makes no sense. And then even if we got to another planet, we're going to treat it like this one. We're going to have the same issues. How is that any better? I just don't see it. Beyond just a singularity cult, I think that's another huge fallacy and a total waste of time, and anything to do with space before we figure out what the hell we're doing here is stupid. But maybe that's too harsh. I don't know.
Well, I'd say the only thing that might be forgiving about it is the fact of having a unified goal for many people, which I think often puts people on the same wavelength.
Well, it's an optimism.
Yeah.
Just like Camo said, I can sympathize with it in a lot of ways. It is romantic and there's something to it. And getting momentum behind something in a collective level is, I think that's for anyone that has a point of view or a belief system, that's what they would want. It's like, hey, let's get everyone behind it. But again, even if there is that mass movement, what are we moving towards? It's like we have all this human energy marshaled, but if we're just moving it towards the end of a cliff, it's like, well, that's human energy, but to what end? So I don't know. It's like, it is a good question. It's not like I don't think we couldn't be in space one day or extend ourselves, but as is, we're putting the cart before the horse kind of in a lot of ways. So yeah, that's just an interesting subject. And even again, like someone like Wilson, who agree with him on everything, and then that, and I can't mesh with him at all.
I am very much in favor of robotic exploration of space. And somebody on this discussion thread that I was talking about was saying that his personal rapture would be, you know, when humanity reaches Mars. And my response was, you know, human agency has been at work on Mars since the 1970s. There are multiple robotic probes on the surface right now, actively doing things. That is human agency extended to Mars. Why does it have to be human bodies on Mars? Human bodies are not adapted for Mars. These robots are built to operate in that environment, and they do it really well. I think NASA sometimes, they underpromise in order to overdeliver. You know, they say, okay, this probe is going to operate for 14 days on the surface. And then 3 years later, when it's still working, they say, hey, it's all gravy. It's a bonus. You know, if it had worked for 14 days and then stopped, they would have said, hey, mission accomplished.
Good point. I didn't think of it that way. I think the two myths you brought up were Charles Eisenstein tropes, or at least what he harps on. And Charles is like a big inspiration for me too. And before we got on the call, I mentioned Joe Bagent. And they, in a way, blend an awareness of social issues with a sense of personal, I guess, I hate the term spirituality. I hate the term religion. I don't know what else to do. Ethics, like personal ethics, maybe. You know, that's a loaded term. But I've always appreciated their approaches to these questions and the self-reflection that they promote. Because in so many ways, again, like even if we're talking about, and if you're reading environmentalists, they will say, well, we have this external solution, blah, blah, blah. But Charles and Joe were more about, look at yourself, look in the mirror, like the enemy is us. And then how do you change your own behavior? And that's really all you can start to do. Observe, report, maybe inspire others. But there's this, yeah, this illusion to get everyone on board. And it's just, it doesn't seem like it's going to happen. And so they seem to be touching on, well, Joe before he passed and Charles still, they seem to be focusing on this idea of like, well, what can we do in this sort of really melancholy era of decline that we find ourselves in?
It doesn't have to be melancholy, though. You know, I just came yesterday from I went to a party on a boat that somebody lives on. It's a former ferry boat, and they, you know, it's their house, and they're all Burning Man people. And I've never been to Burning Man, but I'm, you know, I live with a burner, and I'm into the Burning Man community here, which has a really significant overlap with also the psychedelic underground, but also the maker culture. And the people who go to Burning Man, and particularly the maker culture people who are involved there, are really optimistic about utilizing the tools that are becoming available to us, you know, 3D printers, increasingly cheap sensors and microprocessors, and mixing that with a really, you know, sort of roll up your sleeves and get out the grinder or the spot welder or whatnot, and just make something physical. And there's a dynamism there and a joy that I don't think it's anomalous. I don't think that they fail to see, you know, the gravity of our situation. I think they have just intentionally adopted a sort of joyous approach, and it's great. I don't see any reason for gloom, although I certainly can understand people who are really bummed out by the mass extinction, which we are certainly living through and probably causing, and having, you know, great compassion for non-human life on Earth and for the human life, which, while thriving in terms of numbers, in terms of individual experience, is often quite dreary, miserable, stressful, marked by suffering and pain and fear and all the things that we would like to alleviate in ourselves and others. So, you know, there's certainly reason to be bummed out, but it's not necessary. And it seems to me that ultimately it's a choice. You can look at the full picture and you can see lots of things to be happy about, and you can see lots of things to be unhappy about. And it just seems to me that the ultimate choice is, well, what do I want to focus on? And if I focus on the things that make me unhappy and I just feed my own experience of being unhappy, what is that doing for the world that other people live in? What is that doing for the environment that other people have to navigate through? Which is why I have sworn off what I call doomer porn on the Sea Realm podcast, because there is an appetite for people who think everything is hopeless, everything is useless. I just want to hear an affirmation of that hopelessness again and again so that I can excuse myself from doing what I can with what is available to me in the moment.
I guess as an artist, and you've done these really interesting comic strips, I think there's 22 in all, maybe there's more. What were you trying to accomplish in writing that? Because it seems to just, you know, it asks the questions, but it doesn't give strict answers, but it alludes again to, we try to ride the fence, but we all lean in one direction or the other. So it leans in a direction, but there's also a certain ambiguity to, I guess, the questions you're asking there. And it's, I don't know if it's Zen or not, but where are you going with that comic strip? And I guess, what are you trying to communicate with it generally?
It's not that I have a particular message that I want to communicate. I created the two main characters that you've seen in most of the strips when I was a grad student and I was doing that comic strip in the university newspaper. And, you know, I spent a long time learning to draw and learning to do comics, and it just seemed really odd that I had invested all that time and energy in creating, you know, this facility, and that I had these characters that I really enjoyed, you know, being in their presence and giving them the opportunity to speak, and I wasn't doing anything with it. So it's not so much that I have a particular message that I want to spread with the comic. I just wanted those characters back in my life, and I wanted to put the skills that I had spent so much time and energy cultivating to use.
And I guess for me personally, like, is, I don't know if I consider myself an artist necessarily, but so often with these dialogues or the times that I do manage to draw or write or something, it really is, for me, it's a meditation. It's a form of inner dialogue. It helps me sort out my own issues. And if other people pay attention to it, great. If not, that kind of wasn't why I was doing it in the first place anymore. I feel like whatever I produce or whatever I consider my art, it has to be highly personal and motivated from that personal place, because even if people pay attention, doesn't mean they're going to support you, or sometimes people won't even pay attention to you. And so I guess detaching yourself from that is for me, that was one of the harder parts, getting into this and finally detaching myself from it. And in that sense, then it's easier and actually more satisfying when you don't have those external rewards hanging over your head, or that need for an external pat on the back or something, kind of like is ingrained with us through our education system, you know, through our grade systems and what have you.
Well, I like getting those thumbs up, you know, those likes and whatnot as much as anybody. So I'm certainly not free from external rewards. But yeah, I'm fortunate in that the comic it's in a place now where I do it because I'm glad that the comics exist. So I'm certainly not swearing off external rewards. And they feel good when they come my way.
Sure.
But yeah, I'm fortunate in that I found some intrinsic rewards that motivate me.
I think one of the big benefits of talking about the comic strips and just arts in general is the way that they build community. And I mean, even the podcasts that we're doing build community. And you had mentioned earlier the myth of individual selves and just how a community can have that positive impact by sharing ideas. And I think that, you know, any kind of media that brings people together is interesting to look at through the lens of that myth of individual selves. But, you know, people really talk about television shows a lot. You know, I go to work every day and everyone's just talking about what television show they saw. So the messages that are embedded within are really important. And I think, you know, however small or large the audiences may be to these alternative kind of podcasts, it's important that we're getting them out there and forming that community, you know?
I saw a documentary about people who are very interested in zombie media. And, you know, I do a zombie-themed podcast. And this was a group of people in, I think it was St. Louis, and they were just very interested in the concept of zombie apocalypse survival. And they got into a sort of a survivalist kick for a time, but then they realized that really your main implement of survival in the zombie apocalypse is other people. And that the best thing to have in the zombie apocalypse is not a gun or a stockpile of rations. It is a community of people that care about your welfare and you care about theirs. And they started with an interest in zombie, you know, the zombie apocalypse. And they got to a place where they were doing community organizing for its own sake, not even with a zombie theme to it. And so, you know, what seems like something really trivial and mainstream, like being into The Walking Dead, can lead people to value community, which I think is great.
Sure.
I guess maybe the last topic I'd like to touch on real quick is, for my own personal reasons, Joe Bajan, because as I mentioned, he's one of my personal heroes. And I know you didn't interview, I think you only interviewed him once, but I know that after he passed, you and I think it was Doug Lane both did a joint episode or something there. You focused a bit on his work and his legacy. And I guess, how did he influence you, or what did you see the value of his work? Because I always would hope that even posthumously, people would still gravitate to him and find his work, because I find it timeless and it's perennial and very heartfelt. And I always felt that, and it had a huge impact on me.
Well, you know, maybe Joe Bajan is the ultimate example of the value of psychedelics. He's from the South. I'm from the South. I was born in Arkansas. My family's still in Arkansas. And I can totally relate to being the guy who's done ayahuasca and who's interested in a lot of esoteric topics and who has political beliefs that nobody around him shares. And yet, unlike a lot of the people that I encounter here on the East Coast, I know that just because you hold some abhorrent viewpoints doesn't make you an abhorrent person. And his biography, what was it, Rainbow Pie? I just loved that. I loved his stories. You know, he was a good artist. He was a really talented artist. He had an obvious talent for drawing. And somebody came to the door basically selling art school door to door, and he did a drawing test and he mailed it in, and then the person came. And so this art school representative came and was talking to Joe's father and said, look, your son is really talented and we can offer him this partial scholarship. And really the amount of money you have to come up with is not very much. And this opens up a whole life avenue to him, which would be, you know, the person selling it wasn't saying this, but would be a lot better than just being stuck here with all your rednecks. And Joe's father couldn't come up with the money and didn't, as far as I can tell, didn't really even consider it to be a possibility worth contemplating. And yet, you know, Joe still, he got out with writing. But in getting out, he didn't leave it behind. He still identified with Southerners and with conservatives, cultural conservatives, people who don't live or visit either coast of the United States. He could talk to them. He was a liberal himself, a political liberal, but he saw the failings of liberalism. And as he said, he loved to lash the liberals, which endeared him to conservatives. And it gave him an ability to speak to a variety of people who don't speak to each other, which I think is valuable.
Yeah, that's such a powerful ability to have. And that's the strength of the middle road, if you're able to walk it, and not easy at all. And I guess he was the person that opened my eyes to just the alienation around me, the existential crises that are going on in probably most Americans' lives that they don't talk about. Because when we all get together, a lot of times it's everyone's just pretending and reinforcing the consensus reality. It's a, you know, I'm okay, you're okay sort of exchange. And it makes everyone feel good and it gets their endorphins going and so on. And, you know, him just bringing light to these sort of fundamental domesticated primate behaviors that we engage in, day out, just to give ourselves an existential ease and really what the crisis really is on the personal level and the collective level. And I just appreciated the integrity and the honesty approach to subjects. And yeah, that, you know, identifying as a liberal redneck, it's rare. You don't see many people doing that. And just even his book, Dear Hunting with Jesus, was a bit tongue-in-cheek, but where that title comes from is it's a very nuanced political position that he's representing in that funny title. And he was all about nuance, and just, I miss the guy, that's all. And so I jump on the chance to talk about him with anyone that's known about him.
Yeah, I had the chance to meet him face-to-face and stay at his house, and I passed up that particular opportunity, not realizing that there would be no other opportunity, you know, it wouldn't come around again. So I definitely regret that.
Well, a couple months before he got sick and passed, I talked to him myself. And yeah, I was going to make a trip down to Mexico and see him for a little while. And then I started emailing him again, trying to set it up. And I didn't hear back for obvious reasons. He got cancer and he passed not long after that. But yeah, that just broke my heart. Not only just because I miss his writing and I miss his personality on the internet, but just having to miss that chance to have met him or talked to him again. But I always have that 30-minute phone call, and that was a really wonderful experience and something I treasure. And it was so ironic because he was talking about his dogs getting sick and dying on the phone call, and then, you know, not long after that. So
there's an alternate reality where you guys would have met at Joe Bajan's place.
Yeah, in some sort of...
Before this.
Multidimensional. Who knows? As is, this is the reality I'm stuck with for now, so I have to treat it as the only one.
So, KMO, what is coming up for you next? Any new plans for what's going on with C-Realm or anything else?
Well, as I mentioned, I do two weekly podcasts and a comic strip. So I don't really think in terms of arcs. I think in terms of I have a deadline in 2 days. I need to get something together. So that's pretty much my standard operating procedure, is to cast about for something to fill the gaping maw of the next episode. So whatever... Whatever presents itself is what I take advantage of.
All right, so we'll check in 2 days then.
Yeah. Actually, I'll put out a vault episode either today or tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah, I just want to say in closing, it's just your work is it's really brilliant. It's brutally honest. And that's all I can ask from anyone, is an honesty in the face of overwhelming propaganda that everything is okay, both on a collective and individual scale. So it takes guts, I'd say, even though we're not changing the world, but at least we're trying to reclaim our integrity. And so I appreciate you out there being a spokesperson for integrity.
I would never presume to present myself as doing that, but I will take the compliment. So thank you.
Yes, please do. So KMO, thank you again for being with us.
Well, John, Tom, it's been a pleasure.
Likewise. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from the SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune in to our other SyncBook Radio programs, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Mathemagical Radio Hour, Synchronize, Pentimental, and Sync Quick News. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.